bet you you'll last longer, unless they're completely wrong. Anyway, yeah. I had just a glowing feeling that if I could only get to 9,000 feet on the north side of Oyama, I thought my chances would be better. And all this time, the wind is ripping and it's tearing the top of Mount Iliamna. I mean, they've got terrible winds there. And you buff it and fly through rifts of obscurement, which is bad news because some of them are stuffed with rocks. Anyway, I just almost made up my mind that I couldn't get to 9,000 feet. And out of the corner of my left eye, I'm northbound now, I'm making a turn to the left. And out of the corner of my eye, my heart just stood still. And I looked up, and here's the wreckage, would you believe? A big transport airplane scattered for about a half a mile. And I thought I could see numbers. And the obscurement would blow over the thing. More sulfur, volcanic smoke.
Right up on it.
Oh! And I made 7 passes, and I got a good look at the numbers. Half. I got a look at the tail numbers, and I wrote them down. And then I got...
How close to the
ground? Oh, God, 50 feet. And the turbulence, the tremendous thermals and up and down drafts, I got too close. It dropped me right on top of the wreckage. And down, past it, zap. And I, before I forgot the numbers or got distracted further, I wrote them down, zap. I pulled out over the ocean there in a hole, and I call anybody on 3411, and here the military come back. Yes, go ahead, 16 Delta. And I said, hey, is these numbers correct? And they said, that's it, where's he at?
The name Ruby Begonia.
Oh, it's the sunrise in the west and set east. Holy mother, I found it.
And well, you got a citation for that, didn't you? I read that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read that in there.
Oh, man. And man, did I haul anchor.
5 passes or 4 or 5 passes?
7. But I hauled anchor.
Yeah. And there was nobody alive on that.
Oh, no. North side, 8250 foot level. For years I'd come by there and I could still see the wreckage. And then, one day, this is years later. Now, you've got to remember that...
Hey, Don, wait a minute. Before we go away from that, I want to ask you one thing. Now, you said he called you on Christmas Day.
He did.
Okay.
Now, 58.
Like, what time of day was
it? Early in the morning.
Okay. And this all happened on Christmas Day?
No. This happened the day before.
No. I mean, you're going down there.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
He called you first thing in the morning, and you went down there, found the airplane, called him all during Christmas Day.
Yeah. Took all day.
Okay. But
listen, I almost never found it. They'd have found it later.
Yeah.
But to know right then was what they wanted. A 100 times I almost didn't make it and turned around and went home. Because you have to have a little natural preservation in the thing too, or you won't make it either. Boy. But anyway, I wanted to tell you about that, and then a follow-up part was later. The statute of limitations on recovery of lost treasures is 7 years. Now, the military put this off limits and in such tremendously dangerous habitat, unsuitable for recovery, right? Okay, they got a record of her down there. So things rolled along. At the end of the 6th year, guess what happened? I got an anonymous call from somebody I knew. I say, is this the name of Ray Gatz? But we won't mention that. I said, Ray? He's a good partner. And a treasure seeker. And I said, all right. Well, he said he was in Homer. He said, Homer? Well, what are you doing? Well, he says, I've got a little job at Inniskin Bay. And I says, that's all. Yeah, he says, I got a new metal detector, and there's a lot of base metals in the area, and I want to try out a new metal detector. He says, I'll need retractable skis, two airplanes, I've got 4,000 pounds of stuff, a crew of guys, and he says, I wondered if maybe you could bring some of your planes down. So I said, you say you're in a holder? Yeah. Well, I say, fine. I've got this souped-up 170 Cessna on the track, big engine, and a super truck with a big engine. So, come on down. Now, you know, this is going to cost a lot of dough to move all that tonnage and all the people in this new bay. Well, give me an estimate. Well, I buy some off an estimate. I say, well, this price be suitable. Not really what he wants to do. And he said, oh, yeah, no problem. I can be here. I'll just take 2.5 hours. And I'll tell you what, I'll bring the big plane first. And then I'll carry all that tummy, then I'll come and I'll relay the super cup to Minnesota Bay. Months in July. And I was glad to have a gun almost anyplace, but so I moved the tummy to the big plane, switched planes, jumped the super cup, went down there, and I took this gray gas. But I just wanted to test it. All the tonnage is at Industry Bay, airstrip, the old oil field. 40-something. Okay. I've got gas in the plane. He's got his metal detector and all his outfits. He's got a good outdoor. He's got a tough kid. Good craftsman. And he's a smart guy. He's a rock hound. He knows a lot. And he's kind of a poker player, and I say, where do you want to go, Ray? Can you go about 20 miles north? Right? I say, where do you want to go, Ray? 20 miles north. Now if you can go 5 miles west. And get to these big fields strung out in the airplane, and he say, can you land any place around here? And I said, yeah, Ray. I can land you on that cirque over there. I can land you on the pressure ridge here. I can land you on the floor over there. And he said, well, how about this cirque? The cirque is around a finger, way to the head of the floor. I said, nah. I would rather land you over the mountain on the far side in the shadow because there's a better one over there. So I dropped some markers and landed 7,600 feet. He got out his metal detector and the thing was winking and blinking and the bells were gonging and I said, hey! By chance he started swinging around and he pointed back to the east. I say, are you by chance going to try to salvage that Air Force C-54? Well, he says, as long as we're here, that's right. I say, boy, not over my dead body.
This was, you were right near the wreck.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah. I say, listen, I found the wreckage, and there's a lot of good hands in that wreckage. And I was in the old 8th Air Force, and I don't really salvaging anybody, any unfortunates, resource from the wreckage of anything. And I think you ought to leave them late. Furthermore, you're in trouble already because I'm going to leave in 20 seconds. It's just 6 years later, and the statute of limitation runs out next year, not this year. Now, you're going to go with me, or are you going to stay here and walk out? I give you 20 seconds. So give me a big, hard argument. Oh, we almost had a big battle right there on the ice and climbed into the plane and we went back and I relayed all that stuff back to Homer in the super cup. But he paid for the flight, but he never spoke to me hardly since. But if he
was... He was just gonna, what he was after was the cash and the wallets.
Yeah, I don't want
the
any
plane,
part.
No, I realize that, but I mean the plane itself didn't carry any kind of cargo or anything.
Well, it had a bunch of goodies in it. It
he
had
got
a payroll for Shemya, for instance.
Well, listen, I wanted to ask you about something. There's a, you know, guys are always talking about airplanes and all that. And several years back...
On Mount Sanford.
Yeah.
Now here.
What's
well,
the
let
deal
me tell
I
you
the
there? Mount Sanford deal.
There.
Okay.
Is that one of the
now, in 1941 at McGrath, Pan American had a Radio Shack. Now this is related. And the guy that run it was Leighton Bennett. Ever hear of Leighton Bennett? Okay, good hand. Later he flew B-29. So he and I want to buy this monocoupe over flat. It'd sit there and run down condition. It's a good thing we did it, we'd have both got killed. He was working on his license in 40 and 41 and so was I. Okay. He knows where this monocoupe is at. The old miner that owned this had an accident. The thing was in S-state. And the fabric was flapping in the wind and the engine was full of sand. Okay. So, we dreamed about the monocoupe at McGrath. I worked on the survey. He worked for Pan American Communications Shack.
Yeah.
All right. We never bought it. We couldn't get the registration. That was the only thing that saved our lives. But years later, he got himself a wife. He was likewise a communicator. They raised a big family. It's working for the CAA as communicators and weather observers. Later, they moved to Gulfcana, the scene of the Mount Sanford crash, just east of Gulfcana. Okay? I believe on a dark, owly night, Northwest Airlines ran out of luck and plastered into the east approach of Mount Sanford on an instrument inbound course to Anchorage, right, in the middle of a black night. They could see the fire for miles. Also, they could see it from the CA station at Gulfcana. Okay. The thing rode on. They tried, of course, it's in a bad place. The military gave it a look, put it off limits. Too dangerous. Rescue operations, not a chance for anybody to survive. This is a treasure hunt story. All right? Long came spring. Leighton has an old, beat up Stinson with tremendous tire. And he is a very capable. Blue B-29, he had a background of bush plant prior to that. He's on good hands. All right? He and the wife worked for the old CAA station on a hand-to-mouth basis. They make a few dollars spending on the family and living. Then, all of a sudden, Leighton takes a little of his annual leave off. And he and the Stinson disappeared. And when he came back, in a very quiet manner, they both quit their jobs as communicators. Leighton branches out with a Cadillac shortly thereafter. They bought a whole fleet of new airplanes. And they moved to Ames. Now, do you suppose he actually found some of the treasure chests on the Northwest Orient flight?
Wasn't there guys parachuting into that and all this good stuff? A couple guys were good.
They got in there too late. See,
well, was that the same one though, Don, that later on there's a couple of characters from here in Fairbanks or somewhere had a big hairy plan to parachute into it and couldn't get into it?
I think they were too late.
Well, see, right, but is that the same thing?
It's
supposed to be a plane up there with millions of dollars on it.
Yeah, but all of the plane didn't burn. And it's speculation. Did Leighton get to the crash? Well, maybe why don't you call him and ask him?
Mm-hmm.
He would give you the most devious answer you ever heard in your life.
Yeah.
But how else are you going to buy a Cadillac, a whole fleet of new airplanes, and quit your job?
Yeah.
Right? Did he get to the crash? My golly, what a silly question.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about...
But it'd be interesting to know now if that was the same one that I'm thinking about. This thing was... There was articles in the newspaper and the whole thing. And this thing, the airplane was supposed to have been located in a spot in the mountain where there was no way you could get into it except by parachute. In other words, there was actually guys that were going over there and thinking of parachuting into a smoke jumper thing to get the $1 million or whatever it was that was supposed to be on board out. And I wonder if that's the same airplane. I'm not saying that he didn't get in there and get it out before him, Don, but if it's the same airplane, it'd make an interesting story in the book. Because, you know...
You can bet that when that payroll plane went down, every treasure seeker in the world here stood up a foot.
Sure.
But that's the only plane...
You remember that,
don't
you? When those people were trying to parachute into that thing, it was while we were up here. When did this happen?
Oh, I think 44.
Oh, no, then this isn't the same airplane.
47? In there?
Well, in the middle of 40. This isn't the same airplane I'm thinking about. Because this happened, or at least these guys were interested in going in there, since we've been up here.
When's that then?
Oh, no.
I'm sure that this was in the middle of 40.
This is what I'm saying. Do you know anything about this other one?
Well, he only had nothing.
This is over here.
Listen,
the undersea treasure hunters keep looking for old...
Spanish galleon, yeah. But anyway, listen, before I forget it, let me talk about...
It obviously was... Now, look at it. Was there anything off limits when he went up there? We'll assume that he did get the money out of it.
Well, I said that statute of limitations, 7 years. Certainly 7 years didn't slip by before the Cadillacs and the new airplanes and the resignations.
Here. Geez, I wonder if the guy wants to...
I'd suggest that you contact Bennett, and he'll give you a run around you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, true.
Because he's been cross-examined by experts already. But it wouldn't hurt to talk to him. Leighton Bennett, Haynes, Lassiter.
They've investigated him, I expect.
I never heard of him getting in trouble on it. He retained the airplanes and the Cadillac. You can leave it. Leave it like it is. Don't say he found it.
No, right.
Say the indications.
Yeah, right.
Are.
Right.
Just like I said. Would that make a better story? Right. That would be better than him saying, "Yeah, sure, I got $100,000 out
right.
of the deal."
That's right.
Because to leave them know,
right.
not know, is better than leave them
okay,
know
we'll
once
that
you
one.
Get their curiosity going. Okay, here. In the early March part of 1963, I had a brand new airplane. The one I eventually left at Yellow Jacket later to 6,000 foot elevation. Okay, beautiful airplane. Brand new, perfectly tuned, fully equipped. So I was taking some ice fishermen to an excellent location near Kentucky, and I stepped into the communication shack just for a weather check on the pressures. Fish bite better in low pressure areas than high pressure. Okay. The weather was excellent. Practically taboo. Anyway, as I stepped in the shack, I heard a backup frequency, a military backup frequency, which is monitored by the old CAA, FAA communications. Now, I heard somebody say, "Fire, fire, eject, eject, 2-". And I said to Bill Price, the communicator, "What's that mean? Is he on fire and is he bailing out?" And Price said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, wait. And he tried to call him back, F-102, F-102, position. No way, he's gone. Zach, gone. Well, Bill Price, a communicator, on the hotline to the military, said to the effect, did you get the burnout bailout message? And the military come right back. Right, they said he should be 100 miles west of Talkeetna. Or in the county area. The Price said, well, don't stand there. I said, where was he? I'm all warmed up and ready to go. I got a load of fishing. He said, military says, 100 miles west at the Pontilla County area, inbound to Galena.
Tyone?
Yeah, village of Tyone, west of Anchorage, which is only 50 miles west of Tyone.
I always thought that was east of Anchorage.
Oh, no, 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 no. Absolutely not.
I know where Pontilla Lake is.
Well, that's right. Just as like Tyone. But any, you're thinking of the Tyone River. That's by Lake Louise. Let's not do that. Okay, this is Tyone Village. Oh, God, I just thought of another one touching story.
Wait a minute.
So I say, fine. I'm loaded up, topped off and gassed, the airplane's hot, beautiful day, and I go. And I went about to the head of the Yentma Glacier, and it seemed like a cold place.
And how about these fishermen? You got them with you?
No, they said, well, if you're going on a big all-day search, we got to go back to Fairview and have a few beers. I say, fine. And so they got my old Jeep, go back to Fairview, and got really good bar stool for the rest of the day. Anyway, I'm flying along, and I'm over the Yentma Glacier, and it seems cold. And I says, 100 miles west, maybe Village of County, maybe Kachatna. No, too far north. How about Chacachamna? Ah! How about Mount Spurrier? Ah, I said, that feels warm. So, I turned...
It has hunches on you.
Yeah. I turn about 40 degrees from the Yentma Glacier, and I thought, man, I better turn due south. And I turned due south, and 22 minutes from the time I took off, in a far distance, I see a plane! Looked like an oil refinery caught fire. I say, smoke. And I went roaring over there, and here is the pilot of the F-102 just hauling in his big orange and white parachute. His name was Major Markley. And I remembered that he was inbound from Galena with this funeral pier boiling, you know, a death carry, a lot of JP-4. Boy, it was burning like an inferno, and it was going 10,000 feet high. You couldn't miss it. Tremendous mushroom of black smoke, and some 7-8 miles from the parachute. And I got a closer look. I saw the fire. I saw the parachute within seconds. I was still 10 miles away. These are big parachutes that lower those capsules. Big orange is my job. Right out in the middle of a swamp, couldn't miss it. And I made a passy R by, and he gave me one hell of a wave. I mean, man, he jumped up and down and just went in the joint. Man, this is 22 minutes after he bailed out. And I got him. And he's leaping up and down, retrieving his big monster orange and white parachute in the wind. And I just make a big sweep past the fighter, and I'm puzzled because the fighter is pointing westbound, and he's from Galena. The fighter should be pointed eastbound, right? You're going this way and you bail out. Okay, so we later at a party down in Elmendorf. Invites me down to a party, and the first guy I run into is Major Markley, flying the F-102. And I say, hey, so you're Major Markley, huh? Tell me about the about the 102. And I say, first tell me why the F-102 inbound from Galena on the eastbound heading was burning like mad going westbound. He said, well, that's simple. He says, you just slow roll the thing upside down and bail out of it inverted with your eject. Yeah! I say, okay, that solves the problem.
Now, what do you want to... You want to cover airplane crashes. You want to cover those first?
Yeah.
Listen,
I had a story kicking around. Allsworth Point. Now, Babe Allsworth has been in Alaska for 40 years. He raised a large family, and they're all very air-minded. And he teaches the lads, hopefully, how to fly at a tender age, and I mean tender. So,
where is he located?
Down on Tenalian Point on Lake Clark. And
he's still there?
He's an excellent pilot. He's been flying for 40 years. And he has this large family with quite a few young lads, very air-minded. And one day at Tenalian Point, the mail plane rolled in and a traveling salesman staggered out of the mail plane and staggered around and got lost off the end of the runway and was looking for the town. He thought he was at King Salmon. In the meanwhile, the mail plane couldn't find the traveling salesman and departed for King Salmon, which is some distance to the westward. And so the traveling salesman slept a while under some bushes, and the mosquitoes was bad, so he finally woke up and staggered over to Babe Allsworth's house, which is what he thought was King Salmon outskirts, never having been in the country before. And he has his big briefcase with his satchels full of hardware and things that he's selling, and staggered in, and he says, is this King Salmon? And one of the little lad said, no, mister, this is Port Allsworth, known as Point Allsworth, and also known as Port Allsworth. And the traveling salesman says, you mean I'm not in King Salmon? And that's right, sir. Did you come in on the plane? You know the plane left. He says, you did?
Yeah.
Well, I think I went to sleep under a bush out here. Well, he says, will somebody get me the King Salmon? And one of the little five-year-old lads said, yeah, my brother will fly you the King Salmon. And the traveling salesman says, great for small favors, let's go. So they go down about 200 yards, and there's a T-craft on floats. And there's another little lad gassing the plane up. The traveling salesman says, where's your big brother coming so he can take me to King Salmon? I'll miss my plane. And the lad said, just hold it, mister. I got to finish pouring this gas through this chamois. And we'll be all ready to go. And the traveling salesman says, is that so? Is that so? The kid, he says, how old are you? The kid says, I'm 11. Well, when's your big brother coming? Kid says, well, my big brother is in the army. And the traveling salesman says, hey, he says, you mean you're flying the airplane? And the young Allsworth lad says, yes, sir. And the traveling salesman focused his eyeballs and says, listen here, kid, I happen to know there's some CA regulations that says that you can't haul passengers until you're 18 and have a private pilot's license. And the kid says, well, that might be so, but my dad wouldn't let me haul anyone until I was 9 and I'm already 11.
Sad ending.
Well, the lad went on to become an outstanding Bristol Bay, Northwest Alaska airplane pilot. 10 years later, in a Super Cub, overloaded, with two fish count biologists. He spun in and they were all wiped out. The crash.
Where'd the crash?
Over there in Bristol Bay. So the lad that could, all passengers at nine, put in about 2 years as a commercial pilot, fully rated, and then crashed. How about that? Okay, now, let's see. I wanted to talk about, the first one. The,
you know, look at that, when you go on these, try and give me dates.
Yeah, well, I'll give you the dates here.
Time frequency.
Look, this is February the 5th or 6th, or in 53, I believe, and it may have been 54, but probably 53. Okay, now, this is one of the terrible spring storms, always in progress. The settings are the same. Whenever you have a disaster, you know, if it's weather-related, why, and most of them are, why you have a very serious, terrible tragedy and wipe out a lot of people and put a lot of effort into a location in bad weather, and the setting is almost the same. Once the weather's cleared and you've accomplished the find, the thing seems almost impossible that it should have happened at all, because you know the location, the elements have smiled instead of frowned, and here you have a complete turnabout. The sun shines brightly in the beautiful light you can see for miles and all that. Now, usually, in this case, this was a weather accident, and it involved a military C-50 or C-47, that's the DC-3 counterpart. Now remember, this is 53, I believe, or 54, February 4th, 5th, or 6th, thereabouts. Okay, now they was flying low frequency range, inbound to Anchorage, that's 50 miles or 60 or 70 north of Talkeetna. They got into terrible icing, and they got out a radio message that they were in uncontrollable turbulence conditions and the plane was loaded with ice. So they were long overdue, and they pressed the panic button on the old 10th rescue. Could hardly move a muscle because of the terrible weather. It was freezing rime ice and poor visibility, obscured. Terrible winds blew. So I found out late one afternoon, we'll call it about the 4th, 5th, or the 6th, thereabouts, and I had a Super Cub there. So I went out to search, and I made about 5 emergency landings and finally staggered back into Talkeetna, and it was too thick to fly. So, the weather continued throughout the night, and it was mean.
Wait a minute, now you said you made emergency landings. Did
well, I, just to land.
Just to get out of the weather.
I land on the Sioux City River or on a couple of lakes, a couple of places, and wait a few minutes and take right, off again. No wheel, not there's skis. Skis,
more
it's wintertime.
Okay.
There's 10 feet of snow on the level.
Right.
So I'm on skis, and I get the plane all ready to go. I have the old, my now old hangar was new. I had the plane in the hangar, and I was waiting for this ice storm to subside. So long about noon the following day, it appeared that the storm was subsiding and moving through. But there were still all kinds of line squalls. It was a combination of warm fronts, occluded fronts, and a whole terrible combination of weather moving through miles away. So I left about noon, and an hour and a half later, I'm plowing up through the tail end of the line squall. And I look here and I look there, and I'm 70 miles north, and I worked my way south to 50 miles north. And I'm up in a high country, just barely able to negotiate. Terrible winds sweep, more ice, line squalls, but weather, I think, is improving. The barometer's coming up. Okay, occasionally you could see a thin spot, a storm. And then about the 5,000 foot elevation, what should I see but a staggering multitude of tracks? And I thought for a minute, maybe a caribou herd went through here. And then I thought, well, they're not caribou tracks. But you couldn't get close enough to them in the driving, freezing blow to tell just exactly what. And then down the mountain, 1,000 feet or so, I got a little better look, and it looked like a bloody moose trail. And there were three separate trails, bloody.
Is this true?
You're right. No, I realize it. Where was it?
Well, it was 50 miles north of Tao Teton at 5,000 feet near Tulitna Pass. Okay, so I followed the trails and I through the walks and the rifts, and I got down to about the 3,000 foot level, and I see two figures dragging the third one. And lo and behold, they were part of the passengers of the C-47 that pulled apart in midair at about 12,000 feet, had presence of mind to open their parachutes, had landed on this terrible wind-blown 5,000 foot level, and it staggered off the top of the mountain, two dragging the third one. Well, I looked around for a place to land, and about 1,500 feet below, I could see a place to land. So I dropped a hasty note in a brown bag, my favorite, with a tail on it. I had a red surveyor ribbon on that one. Got a good hit. Told him to come down, straight down the mountain, to this small clearing, and I would go for a flight surgeon because they were just packing and dragging the third guy, and it would take them an hour to get that 1,500 feet. And I roared into Tao Teton, and the Air Force had a flight surgeon there.
In Tao Teton?
Yeah.
They were looking.
They were looking, man. And I told them I made a find, I think. They were overjoyed. And they had seven Beaver aircraft. Guess where they were? They were all stuck at Curry in the fresh new snow on that 800 foot strip. Seven Beavers. They had to get a railroad caterpillar to straighten them out. They finally wound up by bulldozing all the snow off the Curry airstrip, 3 feet of wet snow on top of 5 feet of old snow, in order to get those beavers off. But some guy landed a beaver in there. Anyway, I get the flight surgeon, I get the airplane. They didn't have sleeping bags, but they did have a whole room load of wool blankets. And two flight bags full of all, I said, boy, one guy is really hurt, and I can see the blood from 20 feet. And I told him we'd load the airplane up with food and blankets and a hot big gallon thermos of coffee. And we went roaring up there, and we set it out twice on the river there, 15 or 35 miles north of Tao Teton, just to save ourselves on the way in. And then the shifting, blowing, screaming winds let up, and I was able to get up there, and they were about 450 feet from this opening. And I hauled off and landed in this opening, and the flight surgeon bailed out, and we went tearing over with snowshoes to see how badly hurt the third guy was. And he was, he'd almost bled to death. He was cut clear from the back of his head to his left heel. And he was a colored boy from Georgia. And he was just barely conscious, just in terrible pain. And his clothes were tore off. And when he went out of that plane that tore apart midair, he must have hung up on the side because he was lacerated. Anyway, the flight surgeon went to work on him right before we met him. And the other guys arranged the lean-to, and I took my axe and cut some gnarled spruce, and we made a fine lean-to out of these. Had this whole plane load of GI blankets. And then we tied them down, and made a lean to, not big, but, and then the blow really hit. Another series of squalls come through. We got stuck overnight, and it was all night long. I tried to beat the ice off the airplane, because how are you going to fly it if it's covered with 4 inches of ice? Anyway, I'd take plane bows and sweep the ice all night long, all night long. And meanwhile, the flight surgeon put this lad to sleep and went to work sewing on him. Sutured here, he stitched him from his ankle through his ears, mainly on his back. He was terrible.
And so the plane blew apart midair.
It did.
And but these guys parachuted.
Yeah, that's just not all. There was three others managed to get out of that death trap before it hit the ground. Anyway, this colored boy was from Georgia. The other two guys was from North Carolina, and one of them said, man, we had a scrape even after we got on the ground. I said, what happened? He says, you know, the North Carolina drawl. He says, you all know? He said, it's 2-3 in the morning, we're talking. And I drank up the gallon of coffee and listened to her blow, and I'd go out and sweep some more ice off the plane and beat it off with the rope. And I talked to them, and they said, man, I think we almost lost our lives after we got on the ground. I said, what happened, fellas? And they said, this North Carolina guy said, you all know? He says, it was terrible noise, terrible turbulence. This is before the plane broke up. And he said, there was one horrible ripping sound. And the plane just went crazy. And we started terrible gyrations. And he said, the whole side of the plane opened up. And he says, I think we lost the tail. And the rest of it started coming straight down. And he said, they just vacuumed the passengers out into space. There were 16 aboard now. And certainly enough, the tail had come clear off the whole airplane, tore it off with the roots. And it just vacuumed out the victims. Now, six of them made it. Now, they said, yeah, so-and-so, this colored lad, said that when he heard this ripping sound, he knew we was in for trouble. And we all knew we was in for trouble with the terrible G-forces and the confusion of the airplane tearing apart. And he said when they didn't have long to wait because they got vacuumed right out of the airplane. And the whole thing was a screaming wild wind operation. And he said, one by one they realized that they had parachutes. They ripped their parachute. The one Negro boy was a little late ripping his, but he opened it just before they hit into a tremendous pile of rocks. They all landed within several hundred yards of each other. And they all dragged themselves together. And in the howling gale on this windswept 5,000-foot ridge. And they said that this one lad was bleeding profusely, and he was, because man, he left a trail of blood. He would think, personally, I have 2.5 gallons of blood. Looked like he lost about 50 gallons coming off the hill. But anyway, they was all huddled together there in their parachutes, and they said, we're going to freeze. If we stay here on this windblown ridge, we go down, maybe, into the timber. And so they all start staggering around, going off the side of the mountain down towards timber. They thought and hoped that the timber would be in the bottom, which it was. And they went short distance, and in a break, they heard a movement. And This one North Carolina guy, he was pretty spooky anyway, and he says, you know, he says there was 6 or 8 big, shaggy, gray dogs start circling around him. He says, I never did see a big dog like that before. He says, they was that high, they clear up to your chest, and they had long, bushy tails, and their ears laid right back on their head, and they circled around and around us. And as we moved down the side of the mountain, as you come along, these big shaggy gray dogs disappear into the blizzard. I said, hey, fellas, this is wolf country. What you saw was 7 or 8 big shaggy gray wolves.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the break, about noon the following day, we spent all night in the shelter built out of blankets and had a plenty left to roll up in. Survived the night. The lad that was badly cut was recuperated, rejuvenating a little. He was conscious, and we poured enough coffee in him to help bring him around. But anyway, I carried all 4 of them, the flight surgeon last, most badly injured first, to the old village of Curry, and I saw these 7 airplanes down there stuck. And I mean stuck. It was in all directions. They'd land and go crosswise and get stuck in the next 100 feet. The plane was just a mass of stuck airplanes. Okay, so I took the badly injured one. There was no point in landing in those airplanes in a regular obstacle. So I took him to Talkeetna. Then I landed the 2 companions and the flight surgeon in the 2 companions I landed by the old Curry Hotel in the river, not on the field. We're on ski now. And then I took the last guy, I'm running out of gas, straight to Talkeetna, the flight surgeon, because he had used up all his medications. And
did he have any blood here in that?
No. He may have had some plasma, but they didn't have any whole blood. He may have had some plasma. I just don't recall. But anyway, they all survived. Now, furthermore, as I was busy ferrying these 4 people out, they got a helicopter into the air, and they knew the location. And lo and behold, they found 3 more survivors at the 5,000-foot level. Also, when the weather cleared, you could see the C-47, and there was tremendous compression ripples on the tail. That is, like ocean waves on the stabilizer, where the terrible G-force had just tore the airplane apart. And what happened? They got into icing. Look. They can't hold a plane level. It gets away from them. It tips. It spirals. It winds up. He pulls out. The tail comes off. Simple, huh? All right. That's what happened. So, crew of 16, 6 were accounted for and alive, and all but 1 were in pretty fair shape. The colored boy survived. Okay, now they found 16, they found 9. They couldn't find an English colonel that was a cold weather expert. And this bugged them. And they said,
do you remember what his name was then?
Nobody's in the military record. Okay, and this bugged them because here was an important luminary from the RAF and the Canadian Air Force cold weather test, and they couldn't find him. And they said, in view of his tremendous capability, he may have become inundated enough to walk away from the scene of the crash. His parachute may have worked. Likewise, the 6th, he may be in the area. Find him. Ah, man, we looked, you wouldn't believe. The lesson we gave that top of that mountain, and looking for tracks under ideal conditions, no tracks. I said, they said, what do you think happened? I said, hey, the 9 were easy to find in a wreckage. The colonel, tremendous authority on full weather test, made a perfect cut, because the option was that maybe he bailed out, vacuumed out of the airplane like a skin grape, and he likewise may have suffered a concussion in the fall, and he, a man of tremendous endurance, he may be miles away. He could be 100 miles away. So we looked and laced, but I kept looking around the wreckage, and then we got another small skip of snow, and I looked around the wreckage, and I saw some fox tracks, and the colonel in charge of operations, boy, they were really looking that thing off. colonel says, where do you suppose the colonel is? I says, follow the box tracks. So they did, and they found him. Oh, he was half a mile away. Just far enough away so it wasn't obvious to find him.
Well, Don, in other words, all 16 of them didn't get vacuumed out of the airplane.
Nope.
Just the six or...
Well, the six... Well, it was probably the colonel, too. He was fighting. Anyway, I wanted to tell you about that one because I thought that was important.
Yeah, actually, that's a good one. Put that in.
Well, okay. Now, on Christmas Day, 1958... my old friend from Cancer Institute calls out this Christmas Day and says, what are you doing? I say, well, I got,
Who was it that called you?
Ah, God, I don't recall. That's one of the honchos from the Cancer Institute. And said, say, we're having some problems with the C-54. And I say, yeah? What do you mean? Well, he said, way down the Aleutians, in the Shemya area, the C-54 was departing the 24th of December, yesterday, and he never arrived. And the last radio contact was from a point 150 miles south or somewhere in the area. Short of Cole Bay, halfway to Cole Bay, he lost contact. And we expect the worst because now he's overdue, the gas range has run out. And
how long would you do that?
Well, 24 hours. And said, the weather's really not good down there, and there's multi-layers of all kinds of weather. And they said, I forget the exact phrase, but would you be interested in taking a Super Cub and go to see if you could see anything? And see, you got to remember that, boy, we pull all kinds of people out of the bunch. So you see, Kalkina is a strategic location because everybody gets creamed in the area there, hunting, fishing, getting lost, and up in the mountains, they're surrounded by mountains. And when the rescue would be called out, which was every day, but they'd say if you're in the area of Farewell, look for such and such. If you're in the area of Cantishna, look for such and such. If you're, we don't know where, maybe in the Gulcana area, would you keep an eye out for this certain aircraft? Color, description, people flying it. And I say, yeah, and I had pretty good luck recovering quite a few and helping some and making some first finds. It was quite important in the military. I just was a little lucky all the time. So, anyway, I told him, okay, it was bad weather. No question. I said, I will put extra gas in the Super Cub, and I have just installed the number of the plane, the 716 Delta, a powerful HF radio. Say, I could talk to anybody on 3411. He said, fine, if you see anything in the Mount Iliam area, if you can even get down there, why, give us a call. So, I'm heading down the chain, and I go to Trading Bay and to the various peaks and configurations on down toward Lake Iliamna. And the weather's blowing snow and windy as usual, and perfect setup for disaster. And you get in between these layers, see? If you're gonna fly to 8,000-9,000 feet, you have to go through 3 or 4 layers. And there's sometimes breaks in the layers. But it's a hairy situation with just a little old Super Cub. Anyway, I finally work my way down the various peaks, and I finally get to the area of Inniskin Bay, and which is beyond Illion, Inniskin Bay, which is the site of a 40-year-old oil discovery. Okay, and then the storm is buffeting Mount Illiamna, the volcano. Now, since the plane is outbound from Anchorage, heading for Shemya, probably a good place to look would be on the north side of Illiamna, right? Well, the problem was, to the south at Inniskin Bay, the howling gale would blow out enough fog rifts and overcast rifts so you could maybe get to 5,000 feet. On the north side, it was just a mass of swirling snow and freezing rain, and just bad obscured visibility. So I circled around and I looked at what I could see. Didn't see anything except more snow and jagged rocks and volcano rifts of sulfur fumes once in a while. As I got a little to the lee side, since the wind was in the south, and then in a half hour or so, I thought, well, the south side of the mountain is impossible. He was coming from the north, he's got to be at all on the north side, right? If you're flying towards Mount Illiamna from the north, you're going to be in the north area, right? Right, I says, gee, that just seems like a favorable place to look. And about that time, three or four rifts